In light of our topic, I'd like to read 1 Corinthians 13. This is also often known as the love chapter of the Bible. My understanding is that the word love here in the Greek is agape, and in this case, the KJV translates agape as charity 27 times in the New Testament. So these verses are not an isolated case. And so I did some looking up on it, and someone wrote that they thought we would do well to see more of a connection between agape, that is love, and the idea of charity. For example, charity clearly refers to an act of the will and the idea of selfless giving, both of which are inherent in biblical agape. The word love in today's vernacular is sadly short of the biblical concept of agape. So that's an interesting thought that I found, as well as the translators felt no obligation to translate one Greek word or expression by the same English expression every time it's used. And charity here was deemed eminently suitable for that context, someone writes. True charity was understood as love selflessly expressed, precisely the sense in which it is employed. And that the English word charity comes from the Latin charis, which means grace. And so they're connecting, the translators were connecting love and grace together. So interesting. So, 1 Corinthians 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and have not charity, I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth. But whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. And when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity.
Well, it is a pleasure to be back, and thank you so much, Herman, for the initiative. Somewhere around October, I guess, he started knocking on my door already, and here we are. So without much ado, let's begin with our hard work tonight. Now, the topic is healthy marriages, so you must all have an unhealthy marriage. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here, right? That's probably not the case. But I'm sure that all of us tonight will be challenged, and that's my purpose, to think about one statement that often is forgotten, that we heard on a marriage day, if you would be married in our context of our churches and at the marriage forum. Since then, it is fit that you be furthered in this work. The Lord God confirm your purpose which he hath given you, and your beginning be in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth. Heard that statement before? Right? Many times. You ever picked up that one word in there that really doesn't seem to be right, especially not on your wedding day? That you be furthered in this your work. You think that's the right word? Maybe you just get married, you're just cloud 9 or 11 maybe at that stage. You don't think about work. You think about love. Right? And tonight we read 1 Corinthians 13 and the word charity is actually not an adjective or an adverb, it's a verb. It's a doing word. It's a work word. And that's why I think, you know, talks like this tonight are vital for all of us. Now, you're never too old to work on your marriage, even if you are, as I am, maybe 30 years married. Oh, well, that's not, I was 30 years minister. I'm not really 30 years married, but I've been indeed married beyond that. But my first wife passed away, and now Michelle and I are married 26 years, I think it is already. So we've been there, but still a lot of work. For example, this morning it was work. I woke up my wife at 6 o'clock finally, because she's usually up earlier than that, and I saw that WhatsApp thingy was not yet seen. So I thought, what in the world's happening? So at 6 o'clock I phoned once, and then if it doesn't work, you do it another again, because then you override your setting, right? You get an emergency. Then she picked up. She says, hey, what are you doing so late in bed? So it was work to listen. I sat there listening for about 10, 15 minutes. Now, I usually don't do that early in the morning. For me, of course, it was afternoon here. But marriage is work. If you're not ready for that, then you're not ready to get married. I always say to my young people, if you only think about fun, excitement, then you are not ready for the hard work that marriage is. So, thank you for coming tonight. You notice where Jesus began his ministry, right? Where did Jesus begin his public ministry? Help me. If you look on your outline, you'll see it. He do his first miracle, his first symbol, you could call it as well, in the marriage. He didn't begin on the public square, government seat. He didn't begin in the synagogue. He began his first miracle, was at least, in the family setting. I think Arthur Pink makes a big statement on that, and I think he's correct. That is symbolic, because marriage is the center corner piece of the kingdom of Jesus. The kingdom of God is what Jesus came to build. He didn't come to build a church. Jesus came to build a kingdom. Over 100 times he uses that word, and only twice he uses the word church in the whole of the ministry in the Gospels. He's building a kingdom. And the foundation of the kingdom is our marriages, because that's where the word of God is brought to our children in a teaching way and in a living way. They see there what kingdom life is like. And Richard Baxter says, if our families would be God-centered, Christ-filled, Spirit-drenched, most conversions will not take place on Sunday under the preaching of the gospel in the church. But it will take place at home. Now that's a striking statement. So our family life is so important. As Herman just said, think about the second commandment. Yeah, what I do is going to affect my third and fourth generation, unto my third and fourth generation at least. If my marriage is bad, I'm sending off kids in the next marriage that are going to repeat perhaps worse or the same as I was. And so there's a marriage, and those children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren will be affected by what we do. So thank you for being here, for really investing in your marriage life tonight by thinking through the things that I have to share with you. And that's quite a bit, so be prepared for a little bit of a fire hydrant type of subject where you get so much thrown at you that you hardly know where to think at the end of the night. Now, you notice I have 7 ingredients. Can I have an outline myself? I have 7 ingredients that we want to look at tonight. Now, because of the time, we will not look at all 7 in the same depth. Let's just look at the 7 statements when we understand the main purpose of marriage. I'm going to be rather quick on that one, but you are not. But you can notice the word homework. Now, raise your hand, who is going to commit to homework? I'm going home now if you don't commit. So, who is going to commit to homework? Wife, look at your husband. Did he raise his hand? Try that again. Huh? So, number 2, when we understand how we are equally needy, though in different ways, it's an important one. We're going to spend a little bit more time on that. The 3rd one, when we understand the subject of submission and honor, that flows from 3 into 4, that's also where I'm going to spend a little bit more time tonight than I will do on the others. Number 5, when we understand the relation between care and romance. You probably think, you should start on that one. But no, I'm not, because the other ones are building up to this. Then number 6, I will not spend much time on the difference between male and female sexuality. And number 7, I will say a few more things on that, but they're not going to be the majority of my talk in this evening, because there is already and there's enough other materials for that for you to find if you really are looking for it. So, let's then look at the 1st one. 7 ingredients. I don't know why I got the 7. There's no magic in that number, even though it's the number of perfection. I'm sure this is not the number that reflects my topic tonight. Genesis 2:18. Who can quote it? Right off your head. It is not good. Who said that again? God said that. Made everything perfect, beautiful, and he said one thing is not good. It's not good the man be alone. I will make him and help meet. Not one word, 2 words. And help meet for him. And helper that fits his needs. That's really what that means. Yeah, don't think it's help meet. You are my help meet. You're my slave. No, you are, as a husband, as a wife, each other's helpers. But he said it about the wife. Yeah, he said in 2:24 of Genesis also that only the husband is to leave his father and mother. Is that true? Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother. So wives, you don't need to leave your father and mother, right? Nobody makes that application. So then jump back to 2:18. That means that not only is my wife Michelle the help meet for me, I am also the help meet for her. Men, do you think that way about yourself? Well done. If you do. But I meet many men that will always talk about their help meet. And I look at him, so you're talking about yourself, right? Oh, what? No, my wife. I says, you missed the point, mister. You are just the same helper as your wife is, except in different capacities. So what's the main purpose of marriage? Is to provide companionship that fulfills the need we cannot meet alone. I mean, think about it. Adam is a perfect paradise. There's no sin. Relationship with God is perfect. He has everything around that's beautiful, but he's not complete. He is a man with one hand, as it were. Now, you could survive with one hand. But it's handy to have 2. Handier to have 2. Right? Now, if you are married, it's like having 2 hands. If you're not married, it's like having one. That's not incomplete. That's a complete person. But that person is struggling with needs he or she cannot meet being by themselves. That's the point God is observing in Genesis 2:18. So, notice number C, there are common areas of personal needs. I call it the seven strings instrument. All seven strings are personal needs that each one of us have. We have spiritual needs. Ask yourself now for a moment. How am I meeting my spouse's spiritual needs? Do I lift her up in prayer? Do I lift him up in prayer? Do I even pray together? Do we even pray together? Do we pray for each other in each other's presence? Am I showing her particular scriptures when she is discouraged? Is she showing me particular scriptures when I'm discouraged? Yeah? Spiritual needs. Secondly, physical needs. Think about material needs. Food, drink, clothing, safety, security. Those are the physical needs. We are to supply those for one another. Emotional needs, a big one. We're going to look at that a little more. Social needs, companionship. If you've been married for years and you lose your spouse, you know what that means. You feel so alone. The social need is not there. Somebody to talk to, somebody that can listen to you. Somebody that you can just be with, even when you don't talk. Intellectual needs, that's often forgotten. You know, so often mothers miss this one. You know, they've been working for a while, and then they have little children, and they're home, and they miss the intellectual stimulation that they used to have at work and with their colleagues, and you know, just intellectually challenged by what we do. And often they only talk baby talk, and they only have to change diapers and make meals nobody likes. And you know, it can be very, very difficult to be a young mother. So to challenge your wife intellectually, help her to grow, involve her in ways you can, is really an important need that we also forget. Or to challenge each other to read something that's just a little bit above your current level. Always keep doing that to each other. And so you learn. Sexual needs, of course, is an important one. And lastly, recreational needs. We need to enjoy things together. Music, hobby, walking together. For some women, recreational is shopping. That's never understood how that's recreational, in my opinion, except when you go to the men's mall there. The men's mall, that's Menards, or Home Depot. My wife calls that the men's warehouse. Right? That's where you would like, that's where I would like to go sometimes, just to see what tools they have and you know, that kind of stuff. But that's recreational. Now, and my wife never joins me on that trip. But she wants me to join her on her trip. See? Recreational. Now, notice your homework and evaluate each area and write down your needs, your expectations. You do it by yourself. The next week, write down your needs and expectations. I'm going to ask you how many of you have ever done that, but this is the funnest exercise ever. I remember doing this before I got married. Now, of course, that was my second marriage. After my wife had passed away, I remarried, and so I was a little bit of a little pro on that one. So I said to my wife, fiancé Michelle, I want you to write down your needs and your expectations on all these seven areas. Just think, next week, 2 weeks, write them down. I said, don't go beyond 100, okay? So, but do it now. Do it yourself. This is such a fun thing to do. And actually, not fun, it's a really, really useful thing to do. So you do that, how your spouse needs to serve you, or what you expect him or her to do. Now, the second exercise, now you think about what your spouse needs are and expectations are, what you think they are. What you think his needs, her needs, or what she expects you to do. So that's the second list. And both of you have not talked together about these lists, okay? Please do this all by yourself. And then you spend an evening like this, or maybe 10 evenings like this. And you go to your lists. and you're going to mark them. You know, easy. I'll do that. Sweat. That's going to be hard work for that one. Or no way. You know, like if you have an expectation that you want to have the dog in the bedroom, you know, some people like to have dogs in the bedroom. Well, mine is no way, not even the dog in the house. So, you know, but some people have that expectation, like their pets, really to be pets, and they live in their bedrooms, even on their bed. Now, you may like that, but that's not me. So that's an expectation you'll say, no way. Yeah. So it is such an enriching exercise. But there's more than that. What's more? What's more to this exercise? We often are having unverbalized expectations or perhaps needs that we just kind of think the other would read our mind. And they don't. And then sometimes we feel frustrated or disappointed or a little bit angry. And it's not fair. You never told her, him, what you really feel like you need or what you expect. So that's your first assignment. You could actually schedule a marriage retreat. What is that? Well, you give all the kids to your mom and dad. Or somebody else. Now, if you don't have parents or grandparents around you, which was our problem in New Zealand, we moved there and all of a sudden, of course, you have no family. So we arranged it with other couples. Hey, we take your kids for 2 nights, you take our kids. How about that? So you always will find people willing to do that little sacrifice, which isn't really a sacrifice, because it's actually so much fun to have other kids around. Seems like my kids always behave better when there are other kids around. So you do yourself a favor both ways. Right? Am I true about that? There's excitement, there's a new people, new toys, new ideas. But these family retreats are so important. I grew up with a mom and dad who twice a year disappeared, believe me or not, for 5 days. 5 days they disappeared. Where'd they go? Well, somewhere. What'd they do? Lots. But mostly time together. Because they're busy, 7 kids, dad ministry, mom busy, no time for each other. So twice a year they somehow farmed us out. No, they didn't actually. They got people into our house. Don't tell you anything about that. That was not a good idea. Especially when they would make people babysit who have no kids. That was never working well. But that's another story. So don't do that. But please spend time together. What you do tonight is just a little start. I'm not going to make you promise your wife right now. But take a look at her for a moment and give her a wink, saying, we're going to do that. Let's go to the second one. I only said a wink. You know what's happening here? When we understand that both partners are equally needy, though in different ways. Yeah? Genesis 1:27 says, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. So both male and female are created in the image of God. Yet it says, male and female he created him. And it's not just male body and female body that he created. No, it is more accurate to think of it masculinity and femininity he created. Now, especially in these days where genders are completely dismissed as being created by God, very important for us to get our feet on the ground here. God created masculinity and femininity. Characteristics that not always are strictly, completely, you know, always on one person. And that is, of course, where sometimes the confusion can come from. Sometimes there are boys we call sissies. Wrong. Don't do that. We call girls tomboys. Okay, do that. Now, why do I say it that way? If we think, girl, boys, you act like a sissy, what do we really mean? You act like a girl. And then we have girls that sometimes act a little bit tomboyish, and they act a little bit like boy. You notice that sometimes these characteristics that we have made in the stereotype are not always strictly only connected to a boy's or a girl's person. Yeah? So let's be careful with that. But yet, God created totally masculinity and femininity as two separate genders, obviously also with two separate bodies. And there are differences that are beautiful and unique. These differences, and there comes back to this first statement, helpmeet, these differences are fitting like fingers together, like gloves together. Yeah? These different needs that I have as a male are met by my female, and don't think sexual. That's the least of what Michelle does to me as a female. I get other needs, emotional needs, that she needs to meet in me as well. And so does she have emotional needs. Oh, she has also sexual needs, but that's the least need that I meet with her. Yeah? She has emotional needs, she has social needs, she has intellectual needs. And all of those, we were created to meet in each other in the marriage relationship. Yeah? That's the difference between them. So they're complementary in that sense. These differences are hardwired rather than physical. What do I mean? They're not just physically identified, of course. Let me compare a female body and a male body. That's obvious. Yeah? But the differences are far more than muscles and biology and bodies and looks and lines and sizes and feel. These differences are, we are differently wired. Yeah? Differently wired. Let me just ask you a question and see if you can discuss it just in 1 minute at your table. What's the way to a man's heart? Go ahead. Go ahead, discuss it. Okay, that's enough. What's the way to the female's heart? No, no.
Oh, chocolate.
I did. I gave her chocolates this morning, except Valentine's Day was yesterday for me, so I had my chocolates delivered to her yesterday morning. Okay? But that's not the way to my wife's heart, by the way. What's the way to the woman's heart? Yeah, we say the way to the man's heart is to his stomach, right? Well, that's a short way, all right? It's a lot longer than that, ladies, than just the esophagus, I tell you. But it is a statement we make. But it does have truth to it, right? It tells me that I am differently wired than a female. That's the difference between masculinity and femininity. It cannot be erased. It's how God has made us. Yeah. When I ask you, what's the primary emotional needs for males? What's the primary emotional need for females? So now think back, mothers, and when you have conflicts with your sons, ask yourself from now on, am I treating my son respectfully? Because there is a boy already, he can feel it. Yeah? And as I am treating my daughters, fathers, am I having a conflict? Am I speaking her language? Because her language is a different one than the son. That's how God has wired us. Now that, of course, not only in families, that's also when you are in your marriage together. You need to remember that. Both males and females have emotional needs that need to be met if you want to have a healthy marriage. So what is an emotional need? That's not the same as a physical need. Yeah, if our physical needs are not met, we die. Right? Food, drink, safety, we die. But if your emotional needs are not met, you will not literally die. Yeah, if they're not met regularly and consistently and suitably, your marriage will suffer, your marriage will bleed, your marriage will become unhealthy and non-functioning. Think about these emotional needs as the ingredients in a cake. Now, you could skip a few ingredients, maybe not too many, but you could skip one. The cake will be a flop. You can still eat it. Right? Now, you don't want to be serving a flop every time. Now, the same is with marriage. You need to have the right ingredients to make sure that the marriage is tasteful and satisfying and enriching, and that it is something that grows and grows into more and more what God meant it to be. So when our primary emotional needs are satisfied, then we experience happiness, contentment, security, zeal, intimacy, romance. Now get this. If your emotional needs are not met, your romantic fire dies as well. And who wants that to die? That's what fueled you when you were dating. It seems like that's all you thought, all you wanted, all you looked forward to. And somehow, in many marriages, it has died. Was that meant to be that way? You answer that for yourself. I don't think so. But it has to do with the emotional needs. So without me satisfying the primary needs of my spouse, he'll be unhappy, lonely, frustrated, anger, bitter, distant, destructive. And yeah, eventually, many places in the world, they walk away from each other. And sadly, that's happening in church too. Now, in my little short life experience, there's not too many divorces in our churches yet, as we see, at least in my church, that I have been administering, as we see around the world. But when I do my marriage counseling, and when I do my premarital counseling, I find out that the numbers that kids are giving to their parents' marriages are very low. I discuss on second or third session, I discuss the difference between a functional marriage and a dysfunctional marriage. And we go through all the various characteristics. And it says, now, I want you to go home and I want you to evaluate through this reading the nest that you grew up in. What is the background of your family? And next time, I'd like you to just give me one indication on a scale from 0 to 10, where would you place your mom and dad? By these two informations you've gotten from me tonight. And you don't want to hear the numbers. They're sad. That's rarely anybody walks in 8, 9, always around a 5 or sometimes 4, sometimes I have heard a 2. And you look at them, you say, 2? Really? I didn't know that about them. So, mediocre families also in our churches. Yeah, there's lots of it. And the only way we can change this pattern is that you invest in your marriage now, so that when your children grow up and they see your example and they soak in. I grew up in a beautiful marriage, and that has done me so much good as I walked into my adult life in my marriage. But not everybody has that. So, let's look at the primary needs. I will not do the primer. Where you did that one. Primary needs of the male. Now, look, these five are not all the needs, emotional needs. These are the primary needs of a male. And there are five primary needs of a female. There are more, because I also like affection. I also like conversation. I also like honesty, and I also like family, and also like financial support. You notice that I want all the emotional needs that the woman has as well. And I'm sure that the woman wants all, perhaps not all, of the five primary needs of the male. Now, someone, I forget who this was, I now blank on the author, but this author did a research of over 1,000 couples. What are the primary needs? And these are the averages that came out. So you may not be exactly like this, but you're pretty close as a male and a female. My primary need as a male is to be respected, not to be loved. Of course I need love too, but I need to be respected. The male desires admiration. Yeah? Look, think back when your man was young. What did he drive? What did he do that for? Why did he have a truck? Did he need a truck? He's a student in high school. Does he even need a truck now? No, we don't actually need trucks. Even though I'm driving a little SUV today, I'm pretty proud of it because I'm driving a little car in New Zealand. So I'm driving there much higher than the other ones. It feels pretty good, doesn't it? Now, why is that? Because we like it when everybody turns like, wow, what a nice car. That's just us, isn't it? We males like muscles. At least we used to. My son David is doing all his push-ups at home. Why are you doing that? I want to impress the girls, Dad. David, you didn't get it. Look, I don't even have any, but ask my wife how she admires me. But not for my muscle. So that is the male. He wants to be admired. And hearing compliments, hearing appreciation, exceedingly motivates us males. Didn't you? You knew that already, right, ladies? Right? Does he hear it every day? Does he hear it every day? I respect you, I admire you, I appreciate you for whatever he's doing. But he's not doing a whole lot. Okay. And pick up that little one he did. And begin there. It is, honestly. You'll see transformation once you begin to speak the language of the male. You know, some women think they have a license in the way they can talk to their husbands and they can shout and they can cut them down and they can show contempt. Even when their bosses are angry with them, they will not talk like that. Yeah, males need to be respected and they need to be admired. And if we are feeling contempt or are yelled at, it makes us feel vulnerable and we will stay a little longer at work. Right? Am I right, guys? Because they don't talk like that at work. They value me. And so if your husband is spending more and more time, now, listen good, that's not the only reason why he's spending more time there, but that could be a reason that maybe he feels at home. Oh, I get barked at and I feel not valued. I never get any respect or admiration. Well, there may be reasons that he's not getting that. So I'm not making here a blanket statement. It's always an admiration, respect issue. Secondly, the primary needs of males is domestic support. Believe it or not, the heart of every man craves his home to be a haven. And this Bible points to this. Titus 2, verse 5, 1 Timothy 5, verse 14. It's interesting how the Holy Spirit makes Paul write that the woman is the homemaker. The homemaker or the homekeeper or the home manager. That doesn't mean that she has to work only at home. Don't make that application. But what application is this? That the woman's ability, gift, personality, I don't know what it is. There's something in the woman's vibe that makes a home a haven. God has wired that in you. Yeah. For example, a home is something much more closer to the heart to the female than to the male. I mean, I've moved many times, so for me, moving is just moving. But for a female to move a home or flew out of a house is a much more emotional thing. And I understand that. That's her. But we men value the domestic support. So that's a nourishing. We come home from work and we love to sit down with a cup of coffee and with our pantoffels and a fire and everything else. No, that's not what I mean. We don't come home to do that. We'll come to that, guys, in a moment. But it is something we value. So look at your lifestyle. Look at your family. Is that a priority? Number three, we men love recreational companionship. Matter of fact, we rejoice about it. Many men actually really enjoy sharing our recreational time. Now, when I made this point many, many years ago, that was kind of funny. I was doing this lecture in one of the churches in my church, and one of the men, he raised his hand. He says, "I understand this." He says, "I was painting the house here today, boring work to paint the whole house." He said, "My wife, she came sit outside in her chair doing her knitting or whatever. She was just sitting there and looking at me and talking to me and sharing time with me when I was painting. And I felt so good about that. I didn't even understand why. But now I understand she was sharing something that I was doing and supporting me and respecting me." And then somebody else says, "I love it when my wife goes along hunting," but she never does. So I said to him, "And your wife loves it when you go along shopping, and do you do?" "No." He says, "Ask a question. When you were dating her, did you go shopping with her?" "Oh, yeah, I did." "And when you were dating, did you go hunting with him?" "Yeah, I did, but I didn't like it. I just did it." "And did you go like it when you go shopping?" "No, I hated it, especially all the malls that she had to go through." "But why did you do it?" "Oh, because she liked it." Now, that's the key. Now, if you don't like her recreation or his recreation, find a recreation that you both enjoy, like walking or hiking or fishing, because you can talk at some times or you fish, you can always talk. So you do two things at the same time, recreation and talking or listening. Yeah? So, but friends, we don't spend time in recreation together as we used to do that. Playing a game together. When is the last time you as a husband and wife played Monopoly? Or something like that. It is so, it's so fun. It really is. And this is what I mean with recreational activity. We all get busy raising kids, making meals, fixing up the house, and we forget to enjoy the times you used to enjoy. Number D, obviously, sexual fulfillment is big on the list, but not quite as big. Notice it's number four. In this 1,000 men survey, it came as number four, not number one. Now, I'm sure they didn't ask teenagers. Yeah, they asked married men here who have been married for some time. It's not the biggest, but it's still a very important need. Physical attractiveness still remains important. Yeah, obviously we all realize after our wife has had children and they don't stay young, that some of that physical attractiveness is challenged. But it is important, women, to remember that physical attractiveness is how God wired your man. Yeah, so do something about it as you can. Do something about it. Whatever you can. You can't take away the scars and needs, of course, that you've had over your lifetime and journey of motherhood. And that's very sensitive as well, to keep that in mind. And I always say to my wife, she struggles with that too. She says, those are the marks of your love for the children you bore me. So don't you ever, ever, ever think negative about that. They show me that you love me deeply, willing to do that. Primary needs for the women. They want affection. Notice the word sexless affection. That's really important. They are wired for affection. That's the first primary need. They're hungry for affection, which communicates your care, your concern, your attention, your commitment, your service. So when your wife cuddles up for a hug, she's not asking, can we have sex together? That may not at all be on her mind. She's only asking, I need your affection. I need to talk to you. I need you to hold me. I need you to let me feel you are, I'm secure. I just need you to be with me. That's all. It's like a little girl wants to sit on dad's lap and to be held and to be listened to her story, or to her mother, listen up her story. Now this affection, that communicates your protection, that communicates security, validation, approval. That's the word cleaving. You're committed. So, keep that in mind, men. Affection. Sexless affection. And if you only show affection when you desire to have intimate sexual time with your wife, that's not affection. That's called manipulation. That's what it is. Nothing more. I've heard one woman say it to me after a marriage broke apart after 25 years. The only time I heard, I love you, when he wanted to go to bed with me. That's the only time I heard it. That's manipulation, not affection. Women need to hear. Harley writes, affection is the environment of the marriage, while sex is an event in the marriage. So let's major on affections. Yeah, but Pastor, I'm not an affectionate guy. Great. Then become her student tonight and ask your wife tonight, now how do you want me to show affection to you? See, that's one of the needs and expectations when we did earlier. So begin to talk. You are to show affection. That's not a question. It is a divine command. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved his church. So don't come to me and say, well, I'm not an affectionate guy. I'm just a matter-of-fact guy. You know, I'm not one of those guys that want to... You married her, you have the duty to show affection. Number two, conversation. I should have really made that a different word. What do you think I should have said there? What's the primary need of this woman? Huh? Quality time. Listening. That's what she wants. It's really one-way conversation. One-way conversation. No, not entirely. One-way conversation is, you know, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. What did you ever say? What did you say there? Oh, that's one-way conversation. No, no. One-way conversation, I mean, is you're there to listen. Not to correct, not to suggest, not to give her a 5-point. Okay, 1, 2, if you do these 5 things, problems are all solved. Right? I used to do that all the time. My wife comes home with I come home and she has this big story about all and wrong. I said, darling, next time you just do, you know, and I come with my 5-point plan, strategy, and she looks at me like, you don't get it. I said, so I did get it. Then I give you 5 points. Right? But no, she said, I just want you to listen. I said, that's all? That's all. I'm still learning. Right? This morning I'm listening and I'm sitting here biting my tongue, not saying anything about the problem that she was telling me about. And after a while she says, thank you for listening. I'm out. You recognize it, ladies? Do you guys recognize this too or not? Or am I the only one that's just learning slow? They like you to talk. I mean, they like you to listen and they talk. Now, here's a question for homework. If you have a pen, how many hours each week do you have a deep talk together? I said hours, didn't I? Not minutes. How many hours? Setting aside time for that. Guys, men and women, we need to do this. Secondly, thirdly, openness and honesty. What's the word there? I didn't want to put it there. I want you to think. What's the word that lies behind openness and honesty? That is a vital, primary, emotional need for the woman. What's the word behind here? That's almost another T. Trust. Yeah? Women need to have 100% sense of trust in you. So if you're hiding your history on your cell phone, guess what? She's not trusting you. If you cannot trust her with all the history on your Google searches, and if you say, no, it's my phone, you're not going for that. Okay, if your husband does that to you, ladies, then next time close one of the bedrooms and tell you guys, well, that's the room, you may not go in that room ever. That's no room for you to go into. Now, what do you think your guy's going to say?
Why not? What are you hiding behind here?
So trust is so important. There is nothing that you should hide from your spouse, wife. Yeah, if you make decisions without consulting her, wrong. If you refuse to share passwords, I have met men, many to be honest, who will not share their passwords with their spouse. I said, why not? I said, I know why. You're hiding something. And if you do that, you're breaking down your marriage. Number four, females' primary need is family priority commitment. Your wife and your kids crave your positive, creative, committed leadership and involvement in raising the family. We need to guard our time with our families, men. To be overcommitted in all kinds of things and to have all kinds of other things added to your work and to whatever that your family is suffering is wrong. I will not forget when I was a student in the ministry, I was in New Jersey, and one of the old elders of that church came and says, you know, young man, can I visit with you? So I dreaded that visit. I thought, oh, I have to meet this old elder. What is he going to tell me? Now, this is what he told me. He says, young man, I have X amount of kids. I forget how many. He says, but no, it was over 10 or 11 kids. He says, there are maybe 3 of them that go to church. And all the others are even in the wrong church or no church or total atheist. And he says, I don't want you to go ever make that mistake. He says, I lived for 3 things. Number one was my work. Number 2 was my church. And number 3, what was ever left over was my family. And my kids have said to me, Dad, that's not what we want. A religion that makes you neglect Mom and us. Let's keep these things straight. Yeah? Family commitment. It's also what your wife wants. Financial support and stability. Often finances are a huge marriage buster because often undisciplined spending by one or by both. So if you have troubles with that, go find a financial advisor to get some guidance. So I'm not an expert on that at all, but I'm sure you can find some. Let's go to number 3. When we understand that both partners are to submit and honor one another. There's a forgotten verse in the Bible. Ephesians 5:21. That is where Paul starts with the exposition of what commandment? Anybody guess? Ephesians 5:21, submitting oneself on another. 5:22, wives, submit unto your husband. And 24:25, husbands, love your wives. What commandment is that? Interesting. That's the fifth commandment. The fifth commandment, yes. Authority structures. Head, body. 6, father, children. Chapter 6 again, masters, servant. It's all fifth commandment stuff. And that begins with verse 21. Submit yourselves one to another. I put the exclamation marks in there. Submit yourselves, it's about you, to one another in the fear of God. You ever notice that verse? Everything else that follows sits under that verse. It's like an arching verse that sits over every other aspect that Paul begins to expound in Ephesians 5 all the way into chapter 6. Yeah? So we have to submit to one another in the fear of God. What does submission mean? I should ask the guys about that. What does this submission mean here? It's the same word, by the way, that we read a couple of verses later when God says to the female, to the spouse, I should say, to the wife, submit unto your husband. Exact same word. So what does submission mean? Submission means this. Not a passively bending of your neck and obey. Submission means an active enlisting and committing yourselves to do the will of God. Submission is when I embrace the commandment and am willfully and joyfully living out God's commandment. So now go back to the verse. Submit to one another in the fear of God. Applies to me as a husband. I'm to submit. Applies to his wife. She is to submit. Applies to me as a father. I'm to submit. Applies to my children. They're to submit. We're all to submit. We're all having to embrace the command of God. And we need to dedicate ourselves to live out this command. See? That's submission. So submission as a husband means I embrace God's call for me as a husband. Submission for a wife means I embrace God's call for me as a wife. Now, my question, why did God write all these instructions to be read publicly? Herman kind of made a little comment about that. Like all these young people here tonight, they're going to listen to how we are mom and dad, and they're going to come back and tell us how to do it. Is that why God have it written in the Bible? Did God give these instructions to be read publicly? So you know, we can go home and we can give a lecture to our wife. Now, look, God told you to submit to me, okay? Listen to that. Now, if you make that interpretation, then be careful, because then tomorrow your child might say to you, and God said, don't provoke your child to wrath, Dad. You don't want to hear that out of his mouth, do you? But yet we often say, you are to honor your father and your mother because God said that. Is that why God gives us these commandments? So that we can use them to enforce our will in these situations? No, it's not. I love the writing of William Gout in the word domestical duties. He must be a Puritan. He takes a totally different approach. I'll share it with you here. He says, we are told one another's duties for the purpose of knowing how to make the work the other is called to do easier for them to do. Now, I'm going to repeat that and I'm going to flesh it out if I can remember what I just said. he says, we are told these duties of one another for the purpose of making the work God assigned them to do easier for them. Okay, let's just make this a little. We're told that I, as a husband, I'm to love my wife as Christ served the church. Reading it as a wife, what application must you make of that? You must ask yourself, how will it be easier for my husband to love me? That's the application. And as a husband, I read, wives, submit yourself unto your husband as unto the Lord. I need to ask myself, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do to make it easier for my wife to submit herself to me? That's what God wants you to do with those commandments. Not to bang over your wife's head or your husband had his will for her or him, but for yourself. So as a father, provoke not your child to anger. I need to ask, as a child, what can I do so I do not provoke my father to anger? And what can I do as a father, mother, so that my children will be easier for them to honor me as the parent? You know, dear friends, if you're going to read that chapter from that perspective, you'll see changes in your marriage and in your family. Yeah? We don't need to study his or her duty. Study your own. Remember, submit yourself first unto the Lord's command. Embrace his command. And do what you can do to make it easier for the others to do. So Ephesians, that was Ephesians, and you notice in 1 Peter 3:7 that we also to give honor to the wife. Yeah, the wife is to show honor, reverence to her husband. The husband is also to give honor to the wife as she is the weaker vessel. Now I've always understood that myself. The weaker vessel means she's the emotional one. Yeah? She's wired different, so be careful how you speak. I think William Gouge makes a different observation, and I'm not quite sure that I'm totally on board with it. He says the weaker vessel may also mean that she is in a position of submission where it's easier for us men to abuse our position of authority. I think there's a truth to that. As she's been placed in that position of submission, we, as husbands, need to be very careful we don't abuse that position we have, but show honor to her. Yeah? And that comes to my next section, is when we are understanding and devoting ourselves to carry out our role as a husband and a wife. Who is more important in marriage, the husband or the wife? What do you think? How shall we answer that?
Neither and both.
Neither and both. Ah. Man, you should be here. You have all the answers. I was going to ask you a mechanical question. What's more important for the wheel to turn, the axle or the wheel bearing? Now, I'm no mechanic, so I don't know the answer. But I think they're both important, right? You can't turn that wheel very long without a wheel bearing. But you can't turn it at all either without an axle. So you're right. They're so important, both of them. So to think yourself as a husband, I am more important, you're totally wrong. Try to fight a war with only generals and no soldiers. Is that going to work? No, they're both important. These foot soldiers and these generals that are having a different ranking. Now, think about the word rank. That's the word that God is speaking about in Ephesians 5. The woman has a different rank within the marriage than the husband does. That's obvious. The one is called the head, the other is called the body. I love that, head and body. You wouldn't want a body here, would you? Only a body, not a head.
But you don't want a head ear either only. You want both. Now, what's more important, my head or my body? You know the answer.
The other day, I was leading my youth group, and I asked them a question that they all felt really funny about. But I said, what's more important, guys, your brain or your colon? The last part of your colon, even. And they said, that's so clear. Your brain, of course. I said, guess what? If your colon stopped working today, you're dead tomorrow.
They can't do without each other. Now, that's the same in marriage. There is no more important than the other. We both are giving a different role, but not like this. Like this.
Yes, one is the captain, and the other is the co-pilot. Guess what? I just flew all the way from New Zealand. The co-pilot sits in the tail, correct?
Where then?
Next to the pilot, in the cockpit. The one is pilot, the other is co-pilot. That's a marriage. Not like this. I'm the man, and you're the woman. That's your picture. It's unbiblical. Yeah? God has placed indeed authority in the one more than the other, and that obviously has to be that way, for no airplane would work, and no sail or ship would go with two captains. So to have a well-functioning home and marriage life, I wrote in my outline, we need to understand why and what God meant with the role of the husband and the wife. Now, real quick, husband is the head of the body to whom he is united. I am united to the body, yeah, figuratively speaking, of my wife. And I just have a couple comments, because this is all only refreshing you. To love is a verb and not a feeling. To love your wife as Christ loved his church. The word love is a roll up your sleeve, get your hands dirty and your knees sore word. That's what I would define love. Love is coming off the throne, coming to earth, and ending up in hell. That wasn't just an idea. That was a deed. That's love. I am to love my wife as Christ loved his church. To love is not the same as to like. I don't like getting out of my bed at 5:30 in the morning in New Zealand, in the winter for sure, having to go down, start a fire in our fireplace because we have no nice button on the wall you put on your central heat. I don't like it to go to the coffee machine and brew a coffee. I have not liked it ever. But I do it 6 out of the 7 days. I get one day off. Literally. Now, why do I do that? Yeah. Okay. My wife says, you're the morning person. I'm the night owl. Good. So that works. But I still don't like it. But I do it. And why? I just so thoroughly love that woman who still is snoring next to me. And she loves to be woken up with a cup of smelly coffee. Get it? Now that's love, guys. Now don't think I'm the perfect lover. Don't you ever think that. I'm just using it as an example. I still don't like it. What do I like? Monday morning. What's Monday morning? It's her turn. You see what I mean? That's love. Love is stepping over your feelings. Have you ever thought about that verse? For God so loved the world. What were his feelings to the world?
angry, disgusted, dishonored, hurt, grieved, pained. The feelings of God were not loving, but his deed was. He stepped, Benjamin Warfield opened my eyes to that. He says he stepped over his feelings, as it were, and gave. It's an action word, his own son. What is our task? It is to nourish, to protect, and to lead our wife. As a lover, you have to keep that wheel bearing greased. Guys, you know who are mechanics. I forgot to do that on my camper once. And I had a burning wheel after my car, my camper. Never even heard of packing a wheel bearing. I mean, they don't tell that in seminary. So, I'm just happily pulling my camper and guys behind me, yeah, what? Behind you. So I look at my mirror, I don't see anything. So I stop the car and it's smoking. Oh, what's this? Yeah, wheel bearing not packed. Okay, well, let's do that. You know? That's me. I'm not a mechanic. So, to nourish your wife is to keep that wheel bearing greased. You have to do that not once a year. You have to do this? Give me the answer, guys. You have to do this? Daily. Daily? Let's try it again. You have to do this? I think our forefathers did understand when I talked about that word work, didn't I? But maybe all day, not hourly. But the point is, our wife always needs to feel there's a man out there who, when he has a spare moment, he's thinking of me. He's not forgetting me. Not just on Valentine's Day. That is love. That's nourish. Every day, I'm reminded there's someone in heaven who's thinking about me. Because when he says, where your heart is, where your treasure is, there's your heart. And I happen to be one of his treasures. That means his heart is with me all day. That's how we are to love our wives. And they need to feel that. They need to know that. They need to sense that even then you don't call her every hour as was suggested there perhaps. But and what is the gauge of my love then, Pastor? How much do I have to love her? Okay, God anticipated your question. Here's your answer. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself, for no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but he nourisheth and he cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. That's the gate. When I come home and I'm tired, I feel like sitting down with a cup of wine or coffee and just take it a moment, easy, and just, I just love to nourish my body. Great, do that. Now forget not that your wife is your body. So you just said you were going to do something for your wife, didn't you? Or did I misunderstand you? That's the gauge. Not thinking about myself, but about my body, which is my wife. I'm the head as a husband. Yes, yes, man. Think twice before you get married. Yeah, it's a huge commitment. I say to these young people when they become all their premarital, I says, okay, let's imagine this room here. No doors, no windows, no chairs, no exit. And scrubbing floors, dusting, cleaning for the person that's in the middle of that room, and that's your wife. Are you ready to start that? No. You have to think about that. No exits. No exits. Once you're married until God separates you. There is a commitment for life till death parts you. And your commitment is to work, to sacrifice, to serve. Are you ready, guys? And then don't get straight answers. Yeah, I think I am. No, that's a good answer. Pray that you are realizing what it is to be the husband of your wife. Husbands, we are to be the head. Now that means we are to be proactive leaders, not reactive leaders. A proactive leader is a guy who's committed to grow, he's committed to learn, he sets goals, he's a guy who includes her in the decisions, he discusses the challenges, he says, wife, how is it going? What can we do to help you? How can we get our family in a better order? This is proactive. Not waiting for your wife to come and say, like this one minister, he got a call one day, and there's a woman on the phone, and she says, Pastor, it'd be so wonderful if I could have a conversation with you, because it's very rough lately. So can I set an appointment? She says, yeah, I have agenda here. Let's do tomorrow afternoon, 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock, the door goes, bell goes, and he opens the door, and there's his wife standing before the door. Don't let it come to that, guys. That's not proactive. That's reactive. You need to be inviting your wife for a conversation. Yeah? Please, this is so important. We just go with the flow. No. Marriage is the building stone of the kingdom. Now, let's go to the wife. Much longer on that one, of course. The wife is the leader assistant. That's how I would call you women. You are the leader assistant, and you have been given an honorable ministry. When God says, wives, submit yourselves unto the Lord, as unto your own husbands, he is the head, and he is your leader. You are then to submit yourself to him. You are his assistant. Remember? Not this way. This way. You are the one that is like the meet, help meet. And God calls you to give him that ministry. Yes, the word submit has a military background, and you are not inferior at all. I mean, there are soldiers that are better snipers than the general is, or better fighters than the general is. Yeah? So he's not inferior at all. He has a different position, a different skill, a different rank, and he ministers that in the army to the other leaders. And so in marriage, you have a skill, ladies. So important that we men all need. That's why God created you and us all for helpmates. So submit, I already said to you, is a embracing your position as a leader assistant. And what that mean? You are to dedicate yourself and your abilities, your femininity, to be assistant to your man, to your husband. You have skills. You got insights. You got wisdom. You got 7 senses, not 5. You got an intuition that we guys often miss. And you got a 7th sense that I haven't yet defined. But that's how special you are. Right? You are created by an amazing creator who has given you wisdom, intuition, energy to devote to your husband and in extension to his family. Why? To make his task to love you easier for him. Now, mind you, I forgot to say that a little while ago, so I'm going to repeat that too. Why has God made you the head? To love your wife as Christ loves. To make your wife's calling to submit to you easier for her to do. Let's take that thought along tonight. So God calls you to dedicate all your abilities so that he can become a better leader. Now remember, wives, your husband did not choose the position he's in. He was assigned that position. Yes, your husband may not be as gifted as you with wisdom. He may not have the insight. He may not have the foresight. He may not have the confidence. He may not have the intellectual knowledge. He may not have the ability to relate. He may be somewhat artistic. He may have not the energy. He may have not the observation skills. He may not have the fatherly qualities. He may not have the self-control and the patience or the financial sense, or even he may not have faith in Jesus Christ. And yet, he is your head, assigned by God. And God has put you there next to him so that you can help him to become the leader God wants him to be. See, one of the lessons I go to in premarital counseling is, you know, that woman that you are going to get married to, she's a gem. And that young man you're going to marry is a gem. But guess what? They haven't come out of the ground yet. They're still in the mine. You have to chisel him, her out, and you have to polish him up. And you have to polish her up. And now the rest of your marriage life is God's refining tool to bring the potential out of this man and the potential out of this woman by the grace of God. That's a lifelong commitment. You're never done. There'll be always other things your wife can learn. There's always other things your man can grow in. And you keep. Friends, this makes marriage so beautiful and so enriching until the day God parts you. There's never a moment that a relationship has reached its level. There's always growth possible. And God wants us to grow and grow. And we are given to each other that way. I love this Chad Dixhorn quote. Decisions are to be made by the head, the husband, but God intends him to do that in cooperation with the wife, using her head, her real one, in this case. But you could also say, also in cooperation with her spiritual head. Now, one more comment, guys, and then I'm going to take a break for 5 minutes to stretch your legs. And then the last three are not going to take a huge amount for me to finish. But this last statement is very important. We need to understand the relationship between unconditional love and unconditional respect. Yeah? When God says, love your husbands as Christ, that means unconditional. Unconditional does not mean that your wife can be whatever she is and does whatever she do and so on. No. Unconditional means you don't base your love on her performance. If that's how God loved, we'll all be in hell. God's love is unconditional. He didn't look at us saying, no, let me see. That's stacking all up with that person. Him I will save. That's no gospel. Yeah, so unconditional respect doesn't mean let that guy just walk over you and respect him anyway. That's not what that means. There's too much domestic abuse taking place. If I'm invited for another topic, that'll be my next one. Domestic abuse. Yeah? That is where the relationship between the husband and the wife is completely marred, and the one is controlling the other, usually the husband, sometimes the wife. That's not at all what God means with unconditional love and respect. Unconditional husband's love is the best fuel to feed the wife's unconditional respect of her husband. Keep that in mind. There's a primary and a secondary. Or I may say a primary and a derivative. The unconditional love of the husband is primary. And the unconditional respect of his wife is a secondary derivative. Yeah, it's going to be pretty hard for the woman to show respect to a man who keeps on walking over her feelings, who keeps on disrespecting her language, who uses her only to satisfy himself, either his stomach or his body or his sexual appetite. That's pretty hard to respect a man like that. She'll have to. But that's not what God meant with unconditional respect, friends. That's not at all. When you're not loving your husband, or sorry, your wife, as God intends to, let me rephrase that. If you don't love your wife as God commands, your wife has every right to call you on the carpet and say, "My dear husband, will you go in the back of the psalter and read to me what you promised to me? Before God and before a whole bunch of witnesses, I can call up here to ask whether you said yes to that." As a wife, you got every right to call your husband on the carpet. And if he doesn't listen to that, he is a subject of ecclesiastical discipline for failing to obey God's commandment. So, women, yes, you are to show unconditional respect, but it doesn't mean you have to allow your husband to abuse, control, take away all your rights, all your liberties, and everything else. That's not what God meant. That's this picture. God has this picture in mind. The one is the primary, and the other one is the secondary. So, as focus on what you are doing. You must change how you must grow to make the calling of your spouse easier for him or her to do. That's really a big subject tonight. Because in my marriage counseling, I get to hear that, "Yeah, pastors, he does this and this and this and this and this." And I can listen to an hour of lists over 20 years. I said, "Let's stop this now. We're not going to undo these 20 years anymore. Sadly, you can't go rehash all that. That needs to be confronted, the attitudes, the principles. But let me ask you, what have you done?" And, you know, that kind of a discussion is far more practical if you want to restore a marriage than to rehash the past. There needs to be confession. There needs to be acknowledgement. There needs to be forgiveness. And that still doesn't solve it. Then there needs to be the rebuilding. In some cases, the actual building. So, and I've seen examples of marriages that after 20, 25 years begin to bloom as they've never done before. So there's hope, because with God, with His grace, with His Word, and with His Holy Spirit, within your marriage, through the word of obedience, there's hope. Now, let's conclude now with just a few comments on the importance of understanding the relationship between care and romance. Remember those first days that you started to court each other? I'll give you just a moment to remember that. Wouldn't you say that you were sizzling at that stage? Romance was a big part. You found each other irresistible. Correct? I hope I am correct. You made all kinds of sacrifices. You stayed up late. Back in my days, you wrote letters. Now it's always all text or whatever. You listened for hours on the phone. In my days, with a cord on it, real long. You guys are so blessed, these younger fellows. They can just hide everywhere. We couldn't.
You have to kind of whisper on the horn because your brother was listening.
But we did it, and we listened, and we showed interest. And I said earlier, you joined them on hunting, or you went on shopping. Now, how's that barometer now? How's that barometer of the romantic feelings now? Is that still high? Gotten low? Not even existing, perhaps.
Yeah, but Pastor, that's normal. You know, when you're young, you have those days of love and feelings and so on. It all kind of cools down. You probably not been long enough in the marriage, Mary, Pastor, to know that. Well, I've been there nearly 30 years. Not quite 30, but been there nearly 30 years. And I think that I would probably say that it's more romantic now than I was back then. That doesn't have to end. When Jesus speaks to his church in Ephesus, Revelation 2, you have left the days of the first love. He did not want to see that over, the days of first love. He misses it. He missed that first love in the church in Ephesus. And friends, if you can recall the first love and you say, yeah, that was a long time ago, but that's just history, then there's something wrong. Of course, as we age, we don't have the same drive. I understand that. But it doesn't mean that romance has to be less, different. Feelings, the desires stirred up for one another in the whole of our sexual being and the biology that God has created doesn't need to be over. Now, that is often over. Now, what is the reason? Let's go back to Revelation chapter 2 again. You have left the days of the first love, which no doubt included a lot of affection. Affection, feelings, affection. Really, the heart of true experiential religion is not the head. It's the heart. It is the affection. And Jesus says, I am missing that affection. And then listen to what he says next. And repent ye and do the first works. Do. So he tells that church to get that affection back. Do the things you used to do. Now isn't that interesting? That's the same in marriage. If you want that affection back and you want that desire and those feelings back, you need to do what you first did. And that's the difference between caring, love, and romance. Yeah? The fuel of romantic love is not what she looked like. Not what he looks like. It is what he does. And what she does. Right? That's what I mean, the difference between caring love and romantic love. Caring love are the actions of love we do. What comes next? Caring love are the actions of love we do despite. Come on. Despite my feelings. Ponder that, please. Caring love is the things I do despite my feelings, not always feeling like it. Yeah, this is what you did when you started dating. You did do things you didn't really feel like doing. Be honest, guys. And be honest, men, women. We did do things. And as we did do these things, guess what? We sparked the love of romantic feelings. I still have to watch that. I'll give you an example that I have personally experienced. As I sometimes, as a pastor, am very intensely busy with some woman
who is struggling, perhaps in a marriage or personal life or spiritually, and I give her the attention. What may happen in that woman's heart? Romantic feelings. This is how a lot of pastors go astray. They didn't intend to. They were no perverts. They were no. But as he gives the attention to this woman and she feels the care and the listening ear and the compassion and the understanding and the involvement, then feelings are stirred. And I have experienced that myself. Gladly recognized it. So I talked to my wife about it. Says, from now on, I will not counsel a woman without you being in the room or being a CC in the email or having a phone on your ear. And the woman I'm talking to will have to know that. That's my protection. Because I'm also a man. And I can stir easily the romantic fire. See, when I discovered that, I started reading a book about how an affair starts. Now, don't worry. I know bad ideas. I don't want to start an affair. But I said, how does an affair start? Don't you see that sometimes you see a man who has a beautiful, beautiful woman. And he ends up running off with a woman you think is a man. Now, why would he go along with her having such a gorgeous woman? Right? You think, why? So I was curious about that question. Now, I read a book. It's very simple. This man may have a beautiful woman, but he has no good relationship, fighting, arguing, shallow. And he goes to his work, and he comes to work a little bit depressed, and he sits down, and his secretary says, well, John, you don't look very happy today. Let me fix you a cup of coffee. Oh, thank you. So she brings him a cup of coffee. No ill intent on the secretary. No ill intent. She just wants to care for her boss. Ah, oh, thank you so much. Next day, she does the same thing. He says, you don't look very happy, John. Things are wrong. Yeah, I got issues at home. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. She may be totally genuine. But what she's doing? She's showing caring love to this man. And if this goes on long enough, this man and woman will get feelings for each other. And that's how it starts. Now, that's now a secret you need to take home tonight. If your romance has died down, there's a reason for it. Start dating your wife tonight. Again. Go do the things you used to do, not only on Valentine's Day. They still love flowers any other day. They still love to get a text. Can't wait to get home tonight to do the dishes for you.
Well, what's so funny? All I'm trying to illustrate, friend.
All I'm trying to illustrate the relationship between caring and romantic love. If there is no caring love, there will be no romanticism. And I know about you. I like romantic love.
Now, you have to be careful, of course, if you're caring love. You have to make sure you speak the love language of your spouse. Just a little caution here. Now, if you're caring love, get this, if you're caring love fails to weave into the needs and expectations of your wife, what do you get? You get wildfire. You don't want that. You're going to burn. So what I mean practically, let's imagine that you just think, I am going to serve my wife breakfast on bed. So I sneak out of the bedroom and I bake bacon and eggs and I get into the bedroom and she begins to go, because she hates the smell of bacon and eggs. Now, all your caring love went up in flames. So you got to know, what is your wife's expectation? How does she want to be cared for?
Otherwise, you're speaking the wrong love language and you don't weave together practically. Yeah? So just a little experiential wisdom. Last one. Oh, no, last two, but the last, it's number six, friends. I don't have to really expound. We're old enough to know there's a big difference between the male and the female sexuality. Now, if you are not sure about this first statement, that God designed the sexual relation to be pure and pleasurable. This is a gift. I just spent a whole sermon on that here today. Sexuality, the seventh commandment is, God says, protect your sexuality. Because it's my gift to you. That's my first point. We need to begin to think biblically about sexuality and the sexual relationship. There is nothing wrong with that. Matter of fact, God says in Hebrews 13, marriage is honorable and the bed undefiled. Now, our forefathers probably felt a little uneasy to translate the Greek literally. In that verse. But if it literally is translated, it says marriage is honorable in all. And intercourse, the word in the Greek is coitus, which is intercourse, is undefiled. You take the Song of Solomon, please read it just for a moment, only from a marriage perspective. The whole gift of the intimacy, of the joy of a sexual relationship is beautifully, beautifully described. God indeed gives a sacred commandment, and sacred commandment in Proverbs 5, let her be as the loving hind in the pleasant roe, let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. So there's need for you to read if you still have in your mind thinking, well, you know, like the Roman Catholic Church used to say, sexual stuff, that's, you know, under the table. We don't talk about that. It's a necessary evil, they call it. A necessary evil. Wrong. Positive gift that God has given to the human to be enjoyed in the context of marriage. Now, realize we're all differently wired. I don't really have to say that anymore. But I don't have to expound on the men, right? Our sexual biology is wired to our eyes. But please, men, remember that the female sexual biology is wired to touch. And I don't mean with touch, physical touch, though that's very important, and gentle touch, and affectionate caressing of a tired and a hungry body is always a big hit for your wife. Even with you demanding anything else, just give her the caressing and let her feel your love. With touch, I mean, our hands and our body is totally, totally wired to touch. Touch is so important. Babies die when they're not touched. Marriages die when there's no touch. Yeah? So let that happen. But the touch is not only physical. Yeah? Even more important is the emotional touch. You touch your wife. When you see her, you know, mopping that kitchen floor, and you take that mop out of her hand, and you gently lead her to the lazy girl's chair. Do you have those at home? I don't know. Most people only have lazy boy chairs. Now, that is such an emotional thing. When you see they're tired, and you say, darling, escape into the bedroom. I'll clean this up. I'll get these kids off to bed tonight. Go ahead. You know what was a big hit in my wife? I would come home at 4 o'clock. I came out of my study in the home at 4 o'clock. Bye-bye, darling. See you at 10. 10? Yep. Go shop. Go get one of your friends to go eat somewhere. And, you know, shops are open till 12 o'clock in those days, so she came home at 10, and I thought I had a newborn woman. That's such an emotional love, isn't it? To give them the space and to give them the sacrifice, and if you also give them $100 or so.
That's emotional love.
And by the way, the more creative you are,
guys, don't listen, ladies, the more creative you are, the more rewarding. Now, that sounds like a real selfish thing. That's not rewarding for both. Right? This is what stirs the fuel of the romantic fire. I don't know if it's true or not, but I was reading a counselor who said he had a woman that come to her and says, "Pastor or counselor, I am just done with this man. I want to divorce him." He said, "Well, why?" I gave her all this. She said, "Good idea. That's a really good idea. But let's make it a bombshell." "Make it a bombshell? What do you mean?" He said, "Why don't we think about 10 things he really likes?" What do you mean 10 things? "Okay, let's make a list of 10 things that he really likes." "Okay, got 9 or 8. "Okay, well, that's enough. Now, why don't you this whole month do all 8 of them and then drop the bomb? And come talk to me after that." She never came back. After that 1 month, what happened? What do you think happened? That was love. Because the funny thing about love is the more you do it, the more you feel it. That's the secret of how God has wired us. Love in the deed becomes love in the feet. Right? It makes you run for one another. Now, lastly, very important subject. I'm sure you have heard enough about that. Jonathan von Maren is just about a household name in this community, isn't he? Talking about pornography. But we need to understand this sexual intention, God's intention for our sexual life in marriage. Yeah, I would love to take you to a very beautiful study of the Song of Solomon. I've done it in once years ago, just from the perspective of, you know, what does this teach about marriage life? To me, the Song of Solomon is the best marriage counseling book ever written. And that's when I do study with couples who go through marriages, troubles, I do take them to the Song of Solomon. I said, let's just go listen and read what this book actually says about marriage life and see what we can learn from it. But so God pictures it as a delightful thing. And especially today, we need to speak more on this subject because many men are messed up when they step into the marriage bed with pornography in their head. I hear this more and more. Females, young wives, are struggling with the expectations and demands of their spouse to act sexually as they have seen it on the screen. Now, more than ever today, do we need biblical guidance about what God meant with sexual expression of our love. Let me read it to you, 1 Corinthians 7. "Let the husband, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and every woman her own husband. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. But the wife has not power of her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband has not power of his body, but the wife." Now there are some people who say, "Look, you need to do what I call and ask you to do because you have no power over your body, I do." That's devilish interpretation of this verse. Yeah? Don't go that way. This verse means simply that I am to keep the sexual tank of my wife on full all the days of her life. I have no demands on her. I have an obligation to her. That's what God means. She is a woman with sexual desires, sexual needs, different than I as a male.
And I have to render her due benevolence. Like that word. That's what my task is. Kindness, consideration. I have to keep her sexually fulfilled. And one more thing about the word benevolence. Benevolence does not mean do everything I ask you to do. And that needs to be said more today than ever. Sexual intimacy is never, I have it in capital letters and yellow high marker, never forced. There's too much marriage rape. That's not what God ever legislates anywhere. Sexual intimacy is never forced. Not in marriage either. It's never painful. It's never degrading. It is never gross. It is never unnatural, as pornography promotes everywhere. And this beautiful gift that God has given in the tender, beautiful sexual relationship between a husband and a wife has been invaded by sin, of course, in our heart. More so by all the sins of the distortion that we have in our culture. So let us openly seek and speak about it. There's no place here to do details on that. There are some really awesome books written over the years. The one book that I always give, it's a really old one, maybe write down the title, called The Act of Marriage. Wrong title, but good book. It's not The Act of Marriage. The Act of Marriage is commitment to love her, even when she may be very unlovable or unlovely. Yeah, so the wrong title. But LaHaye, Tim LaHaye, LaHaye. If you go to Amazon, you can buy a dozen of these books for real cheap. Recently, I reviewed a book which is a step farther. I'm not sure I agree with everything, but I think it's a good discussion called The Celebration of Sex. I did it in connection with a paper I had to write by Douglas Rochenau. It must be a French name. I'll spell it. R-O-S-E-N-O-U. Very open book if you struggle in this area as husband and wife. This is a book to read together. And together, read a book like that. Yeah, this is part of our prayer life. This will be part of our discussion life. This needs to be open. Why? Because this is a very important aspect. No, it's not the secret of your marriage. It's a barometer of your marriage. If the sexual intimacy doesn't function, there's something wrong. Now, that could be, of course, age things. That's differently. I'm not talking about that. But then you're in the prime of your life, that needs to flourish. And so then, if you struggle with that area, please invest. Invest in reading. There's other books that I don't know by personal reading, so I can't recommend them. So I'm sure there are plenty, but we don't have heaps of time. The book that I quoted tonight by... No, the other one. Where's the book? Yeah. Dickshorn.
Yeah.
Gospel-shaped marriage. That's a beautiful little book. It's a thin one. Not a big one like that. Real thin one. For sale in the bookstore. Yeah, that's a really nice starter. Really, he really does a fantastic job in a short space to enhance even more of what I try tonight unpack a little bit for you. Now, thank you for this. You promised to do the homework, and I'm only overloading you tonight. I know that. If you are interested to hear more on a much slower pace, with some extension I haven't even put in tonight, on sermon audio, I think there are about 7 sessions on this subject of marriage enrichment with homework
outlines, I think, and if you can't find them, then email me. But much more homework than this. And I did those over a period of 7 months rather than one evening, to give you a month in between to work on. And really, I hear so many couples responding how good it is to do that homework. Yeah, that's where you digest into your situation the nuts and bolts of what I'm giving you today.